Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Do you remember when Ohio was a blue state? Democratic strategist Dale Butland does. He spent half his career working side by side with astronaut turned senator John Glenn. He also spent time working for Ohio's other Democratic senator, Howard Metzenbaum. And for about 20 years, starting in 1974, Butland says John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum turned Ohio politics upside down. Butland's new book about that time is called When Ohio Was Blue, and he joins us today. Dale Butland, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
So you say in your acknowledgments that you wrote this book for your grandchildren and so that other young people will know that politics and public service are not dirty words. You wanted them to know that there was a time when there was a different tone. So can you tell me more about that? Tell me why you wrote this book.
Yeah, well, first off, I should mention that my wife and I have 11 grandchildren now and counting, which may be proof positive that we need to start negotiations with the Planned Parenthood Association.
Oh, dear.
But I did think it was important for my grandkids, many of whom are very young now, that at some point when they get older, they'll be able to understand why their grandfather spent a good portion of his career the way he did. Mm-hmm. And I also want them to know, and all grandchildren, not just mine, mm-hmm. to know that politics is not a dirty word. It's not a spectator sport. It is something that we all need to be involved in. Mm-hmm. And if I can just convince a few people of that down the road, I think the book will have been well worth writing.
Well, yeah, you write that you're proud that your children and hopefully someday your grandchildren will be concerned citizens, pay attention to the news, vote, that
yes.
kind of thing. So
yeah.
So you want people to not think of politics as something to ignore. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, it really affects every aspect of our lives. I know a lot of people say, oh, you know, I don't want to get involved in politics, you know. But politics is so important. And really, in a democratic society like we have here, a republic, you need to be involved. That's the whole point. Our founders believed that only by having an involved, educated, when I say educated, I mean civically educated populace, can we survive as a democracy. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to get back to that. I think we need to get people off the sidelines and back into the game. They don't have to run for office. They don't have to be as involved as I've been, maybe. But they need to vote. They need to keep up with the news. They need to know what's going on. And they need to cast a vote.
Hmm. You say early on in the book that for John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum, Ohio's two Democratic senators, that for the two of them, politics wasn't a war. But that is an era that is gone now. Do you think politics is a war today?
I think too often, yeah, it's got an apocalyptic tone to it now that it never had back in the days that I was working for John Glenn. As you said, Amy, John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum and all the politicians like them back then, whether Republican or Democrat, did not view politics as a war. They didn't look at their opponents as enemies. They didn't look at being elected as a license to grift. And they didn't view losing an election as proof that it was rigged or stolen. Mm. And so it was a very different time then. And I think since 2016, with the kind of rule-breaking, norm-smashing, anything-goes politics now, I think people have gotten away from that. I think that people have... Well, we are so divided now as a society. Mm. It's like Democrats and Republicans oftentimes are living in different worlds, living on different planets, where they don't agree on the same values, they don't agree on the same facts. It's as though we live in different realities. Mm-hmm. And part of that is the fact that we have social media now that we didn't have back then. Part of it is we have these ideologically driven cable news networks that can silo us into sort of echo chambers where we never, what we believe or think we know never gets challenged. It only gets reinforced. Mm-hmm. And I think that was not the case back in the 1980s. Back then, when people watched the news, you watched CBS, ABC, or NBC. There were three networks, and you got everyone got pretty
PBS
much.
PBS was in there a little bit too, maybe.
little bit.
Yeah.
That's my Robert De Niro impression. A little bit, mm-hmm. but anyway, the point is, everyone got some version of the same story.
Yeah.
Now that's not the case. There are people who watch nothing but Fox News, or people who watch nothing but MS Now, who never get the other side of the story. And I think it's important for all of us to get both sides of the story, to listen carefully, and to use our critical thinking capacities too, you know, not just accept anything we hear as gospel.
So there are probably a lot of people living in Ohio today who have no idea what we're talking about when we say the title of your book, When Ohio Was Blue, yeah. When Ohio Was a Blue State. They might even say, how is that possible? Like, that's not the Ohio I know. So tell me about those 20 years. What was Ohio like, and how in the world was it actually blue?
Yeah. So for most of our state's history, mm-hmm. we've been a middle-of-the-road state with a center-right tilt, but mostly purple in today's color-coded parlance.
Yeah.
Mostly middle-of-the-road purple. Starting in the late 1970s and then going into the 80s and the early 90s, you had John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum, who won. John won four elections to the mm-hmm. Senate, Howard three. John was the only four-term senator in Ohio history. But during that same period, Democrats had every statewide office in Ohio, every executive office, mm-hmm. from the governor on down. We had both houses of the state legislature. We had the Supreme Court, the Ohio Supreme Court. We had both U.S. Senate seats. We had a majority of the congressional delegation. In other words, Ohio in the 1980s was like a mirror image of what Ohio was now, which is entirely red, where they control every statewide office and all the rest. So that was a very different time and in my view, a better time.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with longtime political strategist Dale Butlin about his new book, When Ohio Was Blue, My 20-Year Journey with John Glenn. And I wanted you to tell me more about John Glenn as a politician and a person. You knew him well. You credit him with your career. But were you also friends? Do you say you're friends?
Or? I think that's a fair thing to say, although, I mean, we weren't like pals or buddies. I was always still very respectful of him, and I always called him Senator. Mm. I didn't call him John, or if I did, it wasn't very often. So it was a friendship, but it was also one in which I expressed a lot of deference, I think.
You say when Glenn was first elected, it was as an American hero and a veteran, not necessarily as a Democrat. So you wrote that he transcended partisan politics. Is there anyone out there like that today? Is there anyone who can who can be elected as a hero or a veteran and not partisanly?
That's a good question. And I would say that it's really, I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. Mm-hmm. John was a war hero. He fought in two wars, World War II and Korea, had 149 combat missions. Mm-hmm. He then became part of the astronaut corps. He was one of the original mm-hmm. seven Mercury astronauts and was the first American to orbit the Earth. Mm-hmm. For young people today, or anyone who wasn't around at the time during the Cold War, it's really difficult to explain to them or have them understand just how deep that was and how emotional a time that was. Mm-hmm. This space race with the Soviet Union, space race to the moon, was a really big deal. And John being the first American to orbit the Earth, the Soviets had already done so, was a big deal because it had us catch up. So much so that I might mention, this is not in the book, but when John had a ticker tape parade in New York City mm-hmm. after his orbital flight, there were more tons of confetti dropped during that parade than any parade before or since.
Really?
John told me that he saw mounted police officers in New York City, you know, tough guys with tears rolling down their cheeks.
Oh.
That's how emotional a time that was. That's how big a deal it was. Mm. So when he then ran for public office, everyone remembered his veterans remembered his heroism in the two wars. Everyone remembered he was a national hero for going into space. And so the fact that he was a Democrat was sort of secondary.
Mm.
He's kind of like Eisenhower, you know, I guess in that way. The fact that Eisenhower was a Republican was secondary. Mm. He was a national hero as well for his exploits in World War II, helping us win that war over the Nazis and the Japanese. So now, as John went further in his career, after he ran for president in 1984, and after he had served a few terms in the Senate and had taken positions on a lot of issues that kind of cast him as a Democrat, and the same thing when he ran for president. Obviously, he was running against Ronald Reagan, or would have run had he gotten the nomination. But he was critical of Ronald Reagan. And Reagan was very popular among many conservatives and Republicans. And so John then got tagged more and more as a Democrat. So that by the time he got to his last reelection campaign in 1992, I think it's fair to say everybody knew what he was. And his pluralities kept, not pluralities, his majorities, which were huge, fell over time as he became more and more seen as a Democrat. During his first reelection campaign, he carried every county in Ohio, all 88 counties.
Okay.
That has never been done before, you know, in the history of this state. When he won reelection another time, he won by 1.8 million votes, which was an all-time high. And by the way, Amy, there's something else I might mention here. Back in those days, Ohioans were not all red or all blue. It was not at all unusual for voters then to vote for one candidate, let's say who was a Republican, for president, and vote for a Democrat who was running for the Senate.
It wasn't all just one, you know, the same ticket.
It wasn't all. It wasn't all that kind of thing at all. Split tickets were commonplace. The last time Ohioans voted for candidates for running for president and Senate of different parties running in a concurrent election in the state was 1988. That was with Howard Metzenbaum. Since that time, it's all been pretty much party line votes.
Well, and we should say that John Glenn was also an Ohio boy through and through, born in Cambridge, Ohio. So tell me about his love of Ohio, because, you know, a lot of people took off for Florida for a lot of the time. But John Glenn, you know, Ohio boy, he stayed here, right?
Yeah. Speaking of taking off for Florida, back when he did his second flight into space, when he was 77 years old, we may talk about that later. But I told the Ohio Press Corps that's the first time that a senior citizen had ever left Florida in something other than a Winnebago. John was a country boy. He was raised in New Concord, Ohio, tiny little town just west of Zanesville or east of Zanesville. He had a great childhood growing up. His father used to bring him to Columbus to watch airplanes land and take off from Port Columbus. And that started his lifelong love of aviation. But he had a sort of a normal childhood. They didn't have a Boy Scout troop there, so he started his own. I can't remember what they called it now, but it wasn't the Boy Scouts. It was something else. But it was something. But he hunted, he fished, he did the kinds of things that you would expect a rural boy to do.
So you started out working for him as a speechwriter, eventually became press secretary. But a resume like Glenn's, you know, war hero, astronaut, that the just the confetti anecdote from the ticker tape parade, it had to make your job a little bit easier. I mean, you're writing speeches for a hero.
Well, it made my, I wore many hats, as you know, during the time I worked for Glenn. For a good part of the time, I was press secretary. And one of the things about working for John Glenn then was that I always got my calls returned. It wasn't Senator who from where. Everybody knew this was John Glenn. And so that part was much easier. In terms of writing speeches, that's a different story.
Yeah. Well, there's a great portion of your book about writing speeches for him. But before we take a break, I do want to say that you wrote a lot of speeches for Senator Glenn over the years.
Yeah.
And you mention in the book that, and you say it more than once, that no speech should ever exceed 20 to 25 minutes in length.
Right.
So I have to ask your thoughts on the most recent State of the Union address that clocked in at an hour and 47 minutes. That's a little long by your standards,
right? It's a little long. That's the kind of speech that Castro would have been pleased by. Mm-hmm. Castro, you may remember, was famous for going on for hours at a time. An hour and 47 minutes is a very long time. I know for sure that there are very few people who watch that whole thing. Mm-hmm. Most people tuned out very early. I've always said that the mind can absorb only what the backside can endure. and you cannot keep people, no matter how interesting speakers may think they are, nobody can hold an audience for that length of time. I think the idea of a speech, what you should aim for, is to leave the audience wanting more. Not having them exhausted and wanting the ordeal to end. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Donald Trump does. He tends to be not very disciplined in his speeches or, frankly, much else.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking with longtime political strategist Dale Butlin. His new book is When Ohio Was Blue, My 20-Year Journey with John Glenn. And coming up, we're going to talk about the feud between Ohio's two Democratic senators and how that ended. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Dale Butlin has more than 45 years of experience in government and political communication. He spent about half of his career working for the late U.S. Senator and astronaut John Glenn. His new book chronicles his time as Glenn's right-hand man. The book is called When Ohio Was Blue. And we're talking this hour about Butlin's career, his time with John Glenn, and we're going to get his take on the current political landscape. Dale Butlin, thank you again for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Amy.
So even though Ohio was a blue state and had two Democratic senators, it was not always rainbows and sunshine for the two men. But at first, John Glenn and the other senator, Howard Metzenbaum, did not like each other very much. So in 1974, Metzenbaum was appointed to the Senate by the governor then. And all he had to do was win the election to keep the seat. But tell me about how he messed that up.
So that was 1970.
70, I'm sorry.
When he was appointed to the seat.
Yeah.
John always wanted to run himself for the Senate in 1970. That was his plan. Mm-hmm. And what happened was the sitting U.S. Senator was a Republican by the name of William Saxby, who then took a job as the Attorney General for Richard Nixon. So vacated his seat. Mm-hmm. We had a Democratic governor at that time, Jack Gilligan, who then appointed Howard Metzenbaum to fill out the unexpired term of Mr. Saxby. Mm-hmm. So John was always a little upset about that because he thought he gave Howard an unfair advantage in this race that John expected to run for. So what happened there is that they ran against each other in a primary, John and Howard. Everyone thought John was going to win because he was so well known, had such great name ID. But Howard ran a better campaign and beat him, beat him by a point. Mm. It was very close, but he beat him. Then Howard lost that fall to Robert Taft. So that set up the 1974 primary between John and Howard.
Yes.
And that was a bitter, angry affair that left both men despising one another for years thereafter.
Okay. So tell me what, so that it was bitter, it was angry, but also Metzenbaum kind of said something that kind of got him into a little bit of trouble, right? Yeah. And Glenn used that to his advantage.
Yeah. Howard made the mistake of going after a hero, a national hero.
Yeah.
And he thought he could use, Howard was a very successful businessman. He thought he could use John's lack of experience in the private sector against him. So he started saying that John Glenn had never held a job and had never worked for a living. And it all came to a head at the Cleveland City Club, which was at that time, well, it still is, it's a debate forum where they always had a debate for high-profile races in the state, usually about a week before the election. And it was a big deal back then. It was carried live by dozens of radio stations around Ohio. Every newspaper in the state was up there covering it. That was back when newspapers mattered. And so anyway, at the Cleveland City Club, John was laying in wait. And Howard referred to John again and said, "You've never held a job. You know, you've never worked for a living." And John said, "You know, Howard, I want you to go with me to a VA hospital like I do all the time. And you look at those young men with their mangled bodies. You look them in the eye and you tell them that they never held a job. I want you to go with me to any Gold Star mother in this state and you look her in the eye and you tell her that her son never held a job. I tell you, Howard Metzenbaum, you should be on your knees every night thanking God that there were some men in this country who held a job. I have held a job, Howard." Boom. With that, the election was over.
Yeah.
That was a mic drop moment, as it were. And
yeah.
John went on to win that race by 8 points. It was a very close race before then. Won it by eight. But, and then Howard got to the Senate a couple of years later.
He ran for the other seat. Yeah.
Correct. In 1976. But they didn't like each other. That race, particularly in 1974, left a legacy of bitterness and anger and hostility that showed up. Each senator tried to one-up the other when Howard got to the Senate, even in very mundane, low-stakes things like the Senate Softball League in the summertime, where they'd those two teams would play each other. This was the Amazing Mets, as Howard's team was called, versus the Right Staff, which was what John's team was called.
Because John had the right stuff,
that's
yes.
That's right. And Howard, of course, the Amazing Mets, it's, you get that right. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was the one game all year that both senators showed up for, and they actually played in. John would pitch. Howard was a designated hitter. Those games were rough and tumble affairs that, you know, the staffs mirrored the anger of their bosses. So out and safe calls were hotly disputed. Tempers were flaring all the time. They were knockdown, drag out things. Sometimes ringers were employed, bringing in outside people that weren't part of the staffs. So that was what was happening during the first number of years that they were in the Senate together. They worked together when they had to on matters that affected Ohio, but they didn't like each other much.
So that was a very different time in Ohio politics than it is today. But despite the fact that Glenn and Metzenbaum did not like each other for a very long time, eventually politics won out. They smoothed things over in order to support each other.
Well, it wasn't just politics. And if I may say, that's one of the things that I'm proudest of sort of orchestrating was the rapprochement between Howard and John. What happened was, shortly after I became press secretary, this was 1986, there's a very conservative newspaper in Washington called the Washington Times that at that time was owned by the Reverend Sung Myung Moon, who was leader of that Unification Church, which is the kind of a cultish kind of church. Anyway, they ran an editorial called Senator Metzenbaum's Red Face, which was ostensibly an attack on Howard for having accepted a fee for arranging a real estate transaction. But it was a double entendre because it ran in conjunction with another column in the same paper that same day that accused Howard of having all these communist connections when he was a young man and actually referred to him as an unrepentant Stalinist. So I went in to see Senator Glenn. I said, "I think you need to go to the floor and make some remarks defending Howard." He said, well, why would I do that? And with the background I just gave you, that's why he asked the question. He hadn't seen the newspaper yet. So I handed him the editorial and the column that was with it. So he read it through and he said, you know, you're right. This is way over the line. So he went to the Senate floor, and what he said in part was that calling Senator Metzenbaum an unrepentant Stalinist is a slur on the character of a man who has served this nation with courage and distinction. He said, I've had my differences with Howard Metzenbaum, but he is a patriotic, loyal American who deserves far better than to be smeared with this kind of warmed-over McCarthyism. Mm. He came back to our office. He wasn't in the office for more than 10 minutes before Howard called to thank him profusely. And then Howard volunteered to be honorary chair of John's reelection campaign in 1986. Mm. 2 years later, John returned the favor and became honorary chair of Howard's reelection campaign, and at Howard's request, loaned me to Howard Metzenbaum for his last reelection campaign, where I served as the communications director.
Yeah, it's a different type of politics because they helped each other out. There were those endorsements, there's key speeches. You were on loan to the Metzenbaum campaign for 9 months, and Senator Glenn was fine with that. When you think back to that time and those two men, how do you reflect on their relationship as it compares to how politics is today? I mean, could you see that today, a campaign loaning someone to another campaign and working together like that?
Yeah, I could, but it would be it would certainly be along party lines. And mm-hmm. like, in other words, I could see a Democratic senator loaning someone to another Democratic senator. But I think the nature of your question really is, again, goes back to the kind of politics that were practiced back at that time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one thing, Amy, that I think your viewers might be interested in is this. Back in the 1980s, you lived in mortal fear, if you ran a campaign, of ever getting caught in a lie. Mm. If the news media ever caught you in a lie, that was horrible. So everything you put on the air in your ads was double, triple checked, you know, for accuracy. Today, we live in like a post-truth society where, well, Donald Trump famously was caught in 30,000 lies during his first term as president. And yet he was reelected. Now you go on, you watch television shows. Truth doesn't matter anymore. The facts don't matter anymore. Sometimes people just make stuff up. And that's what passes now for political argument and debate. Also back then, people trusted the media to be sort of the enforcers. Mm-hmm. If the media caught somebody in a lie, and that's typically where it was, voters would trust the media as being honest brokers, and if they said that a campaign attack was untrue or was over the line, voters would routinely make the offending candidate pay for it at the polls. Mm-hmm. You don't see that much anymore, and there again, I think that was a better world back then.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with longtime political strategist Dale Butlin. His new book is called When Ohio Was Blue, My 20-Year Journey with John Glenn. I wanted to jump to a more random job you had in your career, which is that you worked for a period of time with Jerry Springer. And for listeners who need a refresher on Jerry Springer, he was a lawyer from Cincinnati. He was on Cincinnati City Council. He served as mayor for a year. He was a political reporter and a TV newsman. And that all came before the Jerry Springer Show, which is what he is mostly known for. But then one day he called you. Why did Jerry Springer call you?
There had been news reports that Jerry Springer was thinking about running for the U.S. Senate in 2004. And very serious people routinely dismissed him because of what Jerry called his silly show. They thought nobody who ran that kind of circus could ever be a serious candidate for office. And I wrote an op-ed piece for the Columbus Dispatch, and I said, you know, people who are dismissing this out of hand maybe are a little premature. I think whether Jerry would be should be regarded seriously or not depends on whether he throws his hat or his chair into the ring.
And which is a good line.
And
yeah.
so a couple of days later, I got a call from the county party chair in Hamilton County, which is Cincinnati. Very good friend of Jerry's and an ally of his. He told me Jerry had seen the column and wanted to know if I'd meet with him. So I did. I went down to Cincinnati. We had breakfast for 2 hours. I was impressed with what I heard. This was a very passionate, knowledgeable person about the issues of the day. He was whip smart. As you point out, he had a law degree from Northwestern. He had an undergraduate degree from Tulane. He was knowledgeable about these things. And so at the end of the breakfast, he asked if I would sign on. He said, what I'm thinking about doing is sort of an exploratory effort. And he said, what I'll do is I'll do nonstop public appearances, speeches. I'll do editorial board interviews. I'll do polling, focus groups, all that kind of stuff. I'm going to pay for it all myself. And then we'll see what happens. At the end of that, if it looks like I could be a viable candidate, then I'd like to use maybe my celebrity that I have now, you know, to fight for the causes that I believe in. So at the end of the breakfast, I said, and he wanted me to sign on with him. Mm-hmm. He was going to pay me very, very well to do it. But I said I wanted to think about it. Mm-hmm. I thought about, you know, what were the alternatives? It had been 11 years since the Democrats had elected a senator. Our bench was pretty shallow back then. We had nobody that had the kind of name ID that he did or the ability to generate excitement that he did. And I thought, well, you know, we haven't been winning with conventional candidates. Maybe we should try one who's not so conventional. So I signed on with his exploratory effort. At the end of the day, he decided not to run. Mm-hmm. But you know, Amy, I often have wondered what would have happened had he run.
Yeah, that was my next question, because you said that it was time for Democrats to think outside the box. You wrote that, as you said, that there wasn't a deep bench and his celebrity might work. You actually called him an early version of Donald Trump. Yeah. I mean, tell me more about that.
Jerry's base when he was mayor of Cincinnati and was on council down there was always the west side of Cincinnati, which is the blue-collar, working-class part of the city. And that also is what – those are the people who were endeared to Jerry, ironically, by what he called his silly show.
Hmm.
The rest of the world looked at that show and just saw a depraved – he was the ringleader of a, you know, kind of depraved circus where people talked about things that people didn't talk about in polite society.
Mm-hmm.
Things like I married a horse and all this
yeah.
other. But what low income people and middle income people saw in Jerry was a sympathetic, understanding host who never mocked them, never looked down on them. And so that was his base. And you saw it when we, in 2004, he agreed to give a speech at the Democratic National Convention in Boston, you know, for John Kerry. It was a Rock the Vote event, and it was across the street from Fenway Park, where the Yankees happened to be in town playing the Red Sox. Well, anyone who knows anything about baseball knows that that is one of the most intense rivalries in all of sport. But Jerry managed to secure these outrageously priced tickets so that we could go to the game following his speech, which was right across the street from Fenway. We showed up in like the fourth inning. We walked into the stadium on the third base side. Well, our seats, we didn't know this, but our seats were on the first base side. So we had to walk across this, you know, halfway around this packed stadium that were all focused on this game. They were focused until they saw Jerry.
Mm.
All of a sudden, a tidal wave of people come into the aisles yelling, Jerry, Jerry. They've got programs for him to sign. They've got other stuff, anything suitable for him to sign. They surrounded us, and this mob made it impossible. They clogged the aisles, made it impossible for us to get to our seats. Finally, the ushers managed to restore order and get us back there. But that's the kind of impact he had with many downscale people. I think that had he run for office, I think that his base, in other words, you know, his demographic, was in many ways the same as Trump's. So that's why I say that before Trump, there was Jerry Springer.
Do you think he could have won if he would have gone for it?
I don't know. I mean, I can't sit here and say that. Now, it was a very different time. Party discipline was still pretty much intact. The kind of smash-mouth politics we see today was still a decade away. But I do think this. Unlike Donald Trump, who evokes fear, anger, hatred, grievance, Springer stressed understanding, empathy, and the need, in the words of his famous sign-off, to take care of yourself and each other. I think he still would have had an enormous appeal to lower and middle income people. Whether you actually could have won or not, I don't know, but I will tell you this, Amy, it would have been a hell of a show.
Yeah. We missed the show. This is All Sides, and we are talking with longtime political strategist Dale Butlin. His new book is When Ohio Was Blue. And coming up, we're going to talk about Ohio moving from blue to purple to solid red. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Ohio was not always a red state. For a long time, the state was purple, and it was considered the nation's bellwether state. The phrase was, as Ohio goes, so goes the nation. This is no longer the case. Ohio has been a Republican stronghold for more than a decade now. But our guest today remembers a time before the red state status. He even remembers a time before the purple state status. Dale Butlin has a new book, and it's called When Ohio Was Blue, and he joins us today. Thanks again for being here, Dale.
Pleasure.
So you spend the end of the book talking about the change in our national politics that you've witnessed over the years, but I wanted to reflect a little bit more on Ohio. Ohio voted for the winning presidential candidate in every election from 1964 through 2016. Joe Biden broke that streak in 2020, and that's because Trump won Ohio in 2020, but Biden ended up becoming president. So now that Ohio is a solid red state with a Republican majority in the House and in the Senate, and the only statewide office holder being a Democrat right now is Supreme Court Justice Jennifer Bruner. I want to ask you, you know, what happened to Ohio statewide Democrats?
Well, in a phrase, we lost the working class. We just tanked with the working class. That used to be our base, and it just went south on us. Let me tell you how bad it was, or how bad it is, I should say. 1992 was the year that I ran John's last re-election campaign. Belmont County, which is in the east central part of our state over near the Ohio River, it's a blue-collar, working-class county. Belmont gave us our largest margin of victory in 1992. We won Belmont, John Glenn won Belmont County by 27 points.
Wow, okay.
2024, Sherrod Brown, running for election, lost Belmont County by 23 points.
What a switch.
That is a 50-point swing.
Wow.
In 30 years. And as I say, it's mostly because we lost the working class.
Is losing the working class, I mean, whose fault is that? Is it the Ohio Democratic Party leadership? Do they have responsibility? Who's in charge of keeping the working class in the Democrats' hands?
No, it's much broader than that. It's happened to us nationally, too. And, you know, there are lots of culprits there. There's NAFTA, you know, the trade agreement that sent a lot of jobs down to Mexico and other places. There's globalization, which we embraced as a party, that was supposed to bring economic benefits, huge economic benefits to the country and to everybody. Well, it brought the benefits all right, but they weren't evenly distributed. Those at the top did very, very well. The working class didn't do so well. In fact, it's so bad that over the past 4 years, 64% of all the increases in household wealth went to the top 10% in this country. So globalization played a role. But I think an equally big role was played by culture and culture wars. You know, Amy, I learned a long time ago that politics is downstream from culture. And if people believe that you're out of step culturally, they won't listen to you on much of anything else you have to say. And unfortunately, we got out of step culturally.
Are Ohio Democrats out of step culturally? That, yeah?
Well, I think it's true of the party as a whole in this sense. Look, we are Democrats, and it's in our DNA. We're always going to stand up for the underdog, for the marginalized, for the people who live in the shadows of our society. We are never going to jump on the, hey, let's all beat up on the trans kid bandwagon, and we shouldn't. But by the same token, we cannot let people believe that we care more about pronouns than we do the kitchen table issues that affect everybody. And unfortunately, that's what we did. We allowed a lot of people to think that that's what we cared more more about. And that's why I think it's so important that in this election, as we head toward the midterms, that the Democrats stress affordability, cost of living, all those kinds of kitchen table issues that people care about. And I think they really care about them a lot. One of the things I got wrong about the 2024 election is I thought at the end people would say, well, you know, the price of eggs is too damn high. But this guy, Donald Trump, tried to overturn an election. He fomented an assault on the Capitol of the U.S. He has openly talked about terminating the Constitution. I just can't vote for that guy. Well, that didn't happen.
The price of eggs were too damn high.
The price of eggs was too damn high.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people in this country, the political system we have and even the economic system that we have right now is just not working for them. Many of them are working two and three jobs, and they're still not getting ahead. They still can't get anywhere. And that is top of mind to them. That's what matters most to them when they go to the ballot box.
Do you feel a part of the problem for Democrats in Ohio is the focus on Columbus, Cleveland, and Cincinnati? Those are the Democratic strongholds. But then what about the smaller cities? You know, the Springfields, the Mansfields, the Zanesvilles. Can the Ohio Democratic Party work to win those smaller, mid-sized city-ishes back?
I don't know that we can win them, but it's absolutely mandatory, I think, that we compete and that we show up in those areas. I'm a big advocate for that. You show up everywhere. Howard Metzenbaum, all those years ago, taught me that. Howard was arguably maybe the most liberal member of either house of the Congress back then.
And really?
Yet, okay. And yet he won three terms in Ohio. Well, how did he do that? Well, he won big in the Democratic strongholds, as you say, Cleveland, Columbus, and so on, Toledo and Youngstown back then. But he ran much better than the average Democrat in the Republican areas of the state, you know, the western part of our state, Lima, for example, and all that rural area out there. He didn't win in those areas, but he kept the margin down so that when he did well in the big cities and stuff, it would overcome that. That's how he did it. And he did it by being a populist. I remember we used to do these focus groups when Howard was running and had one guy who tell us, well, I'm supporting Metzenbaum because he's a conservative like me. And we'd say, well, what do you mean? What do you mean by conservative?
Yeah.
And the guy said, well, he stands up to the big oil companies. He doesn't take any crap from the insurance companies. He really stands up for people like me. That's what he meant. Mm. And the power of populism is huge. And I think you need to go into those rural areas. You need to tell people why you're running, how you're going to make life better for them and their families. Even though you're not going to win there, maybe, but you're going to hold that margin, losing margin down so that maybe you can win. I've been very buoyed by the polls recent polls that have shown here in Ohio that Amy Acton is within is either leading or tied.
Yeah, that was my next question. So the Democratic candidate for governor right now is Amy Acton. What do you think of her campaign? How are things going? And how is it going to be whenever she gets closer to this election against Vivek Ramaswamy?
Well, we'll find out. I mean, right now, you know, the polls are showing that she's within striking distance. She could win. The same with Sherrod. I still think it's going to be an uphill battle, but for the first time, I'm really believing that maybe it's possible. And not only in Ohio. I'm thinking that, you know, I do think we're going to take back the House. The Democrats are going to take back the House. We only have to get three seats there, and I think we're going to get far more than that. But the Senate was always going to be a problem for us because the map is terrible. We don't, you know, we are defending a lot of seats. There aren't many vulnerable Republicans this time around. But for the first time in weeks, I think taking back the Senate's a possibility. I think we can take Maine. I think we're going to win North Carolina, which is an open seat there. But, you know, the former governor is running for that. He's very popular. I think he's going to win. If we win Ohio, that's three. Now we only need one more.
You mentioned Ohio third there. So how do you feel Sherrod Brown's chances are?
Well, again, I don't think it's easy, but I think Sherrod is within striking distance, and I think he could possibly pull this off. If it's a red wave, if it's a blue wave year, mm-hmm. then states that weren't competitive all of a sudden become competitive. The same with congressional districts and, you know, so on. So then we'd have to win the fourth seat. That has to come from either Texas, Iowa, or Alaska. Yeah. Could we do it? It's like the equivalent of hitting an inside straight, right? So it's not likely, but it's possible for the first time, in my view.
Let's talk a little bit about the money. The Sherrod Brown-Bernie Moreno race was one of the most expensive Senate races ever in this country. You helped John Glenn win multiple Senate races and Howard Metzenbaum a race or two with a lot less money. I mean, what do you make of how much it costs now to win an election?
Oh, it's just out of this world now. I mean, the Howard Metzenbaum race in 1988 against George Voinovich, who at that time was the mayor of Cleveland, was the most expensive Senate race in Ohio history then. Both sides spent $7 million total.
That's nothing now.
2024, in that race with Sherrod, as you point out, they spent, what, $40 million?
Maybe even more than that. I have to find the number. Yeah.
No, yeah. So, I mean, it's just, actually, it was more than that. But it's just out of control now. There's just too much money in politics now, but you can thank the Supreme Court for that with their Citizens United decision.
I don't want to give too much away, but toward the end of the book, you do say that you're optimistic.
Yes.
You say that America's best days are always ahead of it and not in the past. So what do you say to people listening right now who maybe don't feel as optimistic as you at the moment?
Well, I would say that it's understandable why people don't feel very optimistic now. But you know, I try to look at the grand sweep of history here. And the truth is that this country has been in very difficult positions before. We've been through two world wars. We've been through a pandemic. We've been through a Great Depression. We've been through all kinds of things where it just looked like it was going to be curtains for us. And yet we always managed to emerge better, stronger than we were before on the other side. So I look back at our history and I say that all you need to do is look at our history to think that we have a real shot here to come out of this well. I really end the book, I think, by quoting JFK, who was a very inspirational president for my generation. And so I say this: let us go forth with courage and conviction, united in our resolve to heal this land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own. Mm. It's going to take all of us. But I think that the historical parallels are there. I think that we're in a dark place right now. There's no question. But I think we can survive this, and I think we can come out on the other side better off than we were before.
Do you think that, you know, we live in this age, you know, you wrote that your 20 years with John Glenn, you said he was not a saint. He was a human being who sometimes fell short. But you also say that national heroes are not so easily crowned now in this more cynical age. Can we ever have another hero type, John Glenn type?
Well, so that comes from an op-ed that I wrote for the New York Times right after John passed away. Mm-hmm. And I called it The Last American Hero with a question mark. Mm. Not because other people won't do heroic things. They certainly will, and they have. But John came from an earlier age when we could all cheer for the same national hero. I'm not sure that exists today. I think we've become so polarized and so much in our own silos that I'm not sure we can cheer for the same national heroes anymore. I think it would be good to get back to that. Ticker tape parade should not be reserved for World Series champions or Super Bowl champions. They should be available for people who do great things for this country. And John came from an era where people still believed that government could accomplish big and important things. And unfortunately, I think that day is gone, but I think we all have to work to bring it back.
We have been talking with longtime political strategist Dale Butlin. His new book, When Ohio Was Blue, My 20-Year Journey with John Glenn. Dale, thanks for your time today.
Pleasure, Amy. Thanks for having me.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.